The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Which religion will be the most ancient, the most primitive, the most belonging to a Stone Age society? The one that says human beings came from insects, they got digestive systems, eyes, sensory organisms and all this, they survived perfectly to where they are, or from a blob, or from green slime, or polka-dotted air bubbles in the sea? Which is the most rudimentary, ancient, Stone Age conception? You know, if we really did have separation of church and state, evolution simply couldn't get away with it. Because in the textbooks of thousands upon thousands of school classrooms across our country, included in this even texts on music, literature, art, all the sciences, certainly even mathematics, many other subjects. Oh, there's a lot of evolution in geography, for example, about different races and how they were supposed to develop. All history books, paleontology, archaeology, biology, all the specialized sciences and abstracts of them, loaded with an evolutionary concept. I've never yet seen a textbook that gives you a choice, that says on this side of the book, on this side of the page, is the idea that maybe we all evolved over interminable aeons of time from amoebas and from blobs and from lovesick amoeba and strange creatures that swam around without eyes and just fractured themselves every time somebody told a joke. On the other side of the page is a biblical answer that says in the beginning, God. You know, the way evolution starts out is in the beginning was a hydrogen atom. They really do. And they say, who made the hydrogen atom? We must not ask. Don't bother your pointed little head there, child. You must not ask. We must not go on to ask why. In this series of seven proofs God exists, I have shown you repeatedly some very enormously embarrassing quotations by evolutionists who claim there is no God and how like they are to some of the philosophers, a man named Paul, an apostle, who wrote a good bit of the New Testament of your Bible. We ran across some of these fellows at the Areopagus area, where a lot of them, well, they love to spend their time like a lot of scientists do these days, to tell and to hear some new thing. It was a philosophical age. They had the Stoics and the Epicureans. They had people at both poles. Some believed in beating both poles. Anyhow, at both extremes. Some believed in beating themselves, and this satiated the wrath or the desire for human suffering on the part of a wrathful God that dwelt somewhere up there shooting lightning bolts down at the hapless humankind. Others believed in asceticism, stoicism, self-denial. Some believed in kind of violent orgies. You've seen the picture of Roman orgies and all this. Well, when he got there, they were always eager to hear some new thing. They were broad-minded. You know, rivers can get broad. Sometimes they also get very shallow. That's the way these fellows were. They had a beautiful religion, a just-in-case religion, just like a lot of us do. We want to make sure we don't antagonize anybody, so some people cuss politely. They water it down. You know, from the worst words, they come up with a heck and a darn every now and then. Once in a while, when you're following people along in a golf course, you wonder what kind of a business it is there. Then you figure it out. There's got to be a bunch of theologians that are calling upon God every time they miss a shot. They say God caused an earthquake to move the green. They call their clubs by all sorts of strange theological-sounding names. But, you know, every now and then somebody gets a little bit of caution. They begin to think, maybe I should cuss politely and just in case there is a God. These people were like that. They didn't want to miss anybody. Now, they had altars to insects, crocodiles, worms, and snakes. They had half men and half women and half men and half horses running around half-dressed in the heavens above, shooting arrows at each other. But they didn't want to miss anybody. Now, as Paul looked around at all this paganism, you ever wonder about the Washington Monument? Why on earth is one of the most famous monuments to the father of this country in the shape of an Egyptian obelisk? Somebody ought to look into some of these things. Anyhow, it doesn't mean somebody's going to go tear it down. I hope not, because it's a national monument, and far be it for me to say that that's what people ought to do. That's the people who are responsible to figure that out. But Paul saw obelisks. He saw upright things, you know, like steeples, tails projecting up into the sky. He saw bugs and insects and rabbits and dogs and sheep and cattle and every kind of a conceivable altar. He said, as I passed by and beheld your devotions, now he respected their religion. He was kind to them. He thought it was ignorant. But he said, I beheld your devotions. If he'd have had a camera, he'd have taken a picture. He said, I found an altar. This is in the book of Acts, chapter 17, verse 23. With this inscription, to the unknown God. Now, isn't that beautiful? They had altars to everybody they thought they knew, but just in case they'd missed anybody, they thought they'd better have an altar to an unknown God. Well, he said, whom therefore you ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you, God that made the world and all things therein. That was the God the Apostle Paul believed in, the Creator God who made the world. A little later on he said, for as much then as we are the offspring of God, he revealed, as the Bible does, that God created man in his own image. Now that's the way you recreate. Humankind gives birth to humankind, plant kind to plant kind. And you don't know of any exception to that rule. That was the fourth major proof that I have given kind after kind in the sustaining of these operable laws that exist and that act upon us. Whether we want it to be that way or not, they act upon us. He said, for as much then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone. You know, some of these quotations I've given you are so interesting because it goes back to the so-called first cause, and evolutionists have said time and again that there really isn't even enough time for the longest or the largest allowable aeons of space granted in the wildest imaginings of evolutionary science for the impossible leap to have occurred. They say that a chance genetic pool for these fantastic mutations to bring about things like eyes and ears and digestive systems and the intricate interdependability of the microorganisms and the bacteria inside stomachs, which bring about the digestion of foods and so on, the food chain where you take one little part of it out and the whole thing collapses, they don't have enough time, even in when they say the allowable age of the Earth, because evolution does say the Earth is so old. Well, they disagree, but they say it's so old. Well, God says we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto things that are made, metals and rocks. But science says in the beginning was the hydrogen atom. It talks about rock. Really, in one sense of the word, they even agree partially with the Bible because science does know that human beings are made up of the dust of the earth. Well, he said, and the times of this ignorance God winked at. There was a time when God allowed in his purpose, his program, human beings to be about as ignorant as some of the animals that they farmed and ranched around. But he said, now he commands all men everywhere to repent. And that means to change. It means to be deeply broken up over past sins and misconduct. But it means to change a total lifestyle, a way of life, not only a way of belief, but a way of doing. He continually preached about the resurrection of the dead. That's a different message than you hear today. But you know, this whole question of evolution, it's time that someone took exception to it. Because there is an all-pervading anti-supernaturalistic bias that your children are subjected to continually. And with all of our efforts and with all of the suits and all the fairness doctrine and all the demand for equal time, equal representation, and the minority groups of youth and the minority groups of women and of blacks and Chicanos and the various conventions that have come along, it's a time where people want equal treatment and fairness under the law. Well, it's about time someone began to inform the American and Canadian public alike that the doctrine of evolution is precisely that, a doctrine, that it's a theology, it's a concept of dogma, replete with its own champions, its own prophets and sages. It demands of its adherents a larger and a greater belief in miracles and the inexplicable, that the impossible is made possible in spite of scientific law than even the Bible does. Well, I'm going to show you a four-eyed look at evolution. I'm going to take a four-eyed look at evolution, one of the strangest creatures you have ever seen. And evolution will get a migraine, dizzying headache as it tries to seek a bifocal answer to a little fish that is called Anna Bletz. And that's not an old girlfriend of mine, Anna Bletz. It's a fish that means little four eyes.
Have you ever heard of a fish that uses a water pistol to shoot down its food? Or of a fish that fishes for fish, actually using a fishing rod, a worm, and a whole set of hooks to catch other fish? Or have you ever seen a four-eyed fish? And that's not a fish wearing spectacles either, but one which has four eyes. A pair for seeing above the water, and a pair for seeing below the water, both at the same time. Or have you ever heard of a fish that breathes air? Or of a fish dressed in a clown suit, which tricks other fish into a deadly trap of poison darts? If you or your children have never heard or even seen pictures of these fascinating fish, you need the Ambassador College free publication titled Some Fishy Stories. This magazine-sized 32-page brochure is packed with big, bright, fascinating color pictures and stories about unusual fish. Everything from the spouting archer to the mysterious lungfish that breathes. Some Fishy Stories offers a valuable look at the underwater world of fish. The whole family will enjoy this humorous yet informative presentation. If you want your child to know more about the world in which he lives, give him Some Fishy Stories. Your copy is free of charge. Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.
In the course of this series on evolution and on seven proofs that God exists, we've managed to collect some very beautiful and very exciting film about some of the strangest creatures you have ever seen in all of your life. Now, basically, evolution says it believes in blind chance, first cause, in gradual genetic adaptation and change through resident forces over vast aeons of time, and it seeks to explain some of these strange creatures all around us. Perfectly adapted, perfectly developed, and perfectly designed to survive precisely as they do, how they could have come into existence with no intermediate species that are existing in the fossil record, with no in-betweens today, but a perfectly developed creature doing just what he does. I talked about a four-eyed look, but first, the anglerfish. You know that practically everybody knows that mankind in the early days of his existence on this earth, and I'm not talking about an evolutionary pattern now, but many nations have been dependent upon the sea. And here's a fish that goes fishing. It has this thing out of the top of the roof of its mouth with a fleshy kind of a substance attached there. And the little unsuspecting fish swims near. It dangles this bait. The fish comes up to take a look at it. It thinks it's a worm. And then all of a sudden, with a powerful snap of jaws you can hardly see, the anglerfish devours this unsuspecting little fish that swims too close. Now, I want to give you a quotation that's absolutely incredible about the anglerfish. You'd want to explain something like this, a really technical scientific explanation if evolution seeks to explain it to you. Well, here's the best we could come up with in our research. According to one author in The Living World of the Sea by William J. Comey, quote, through the trial and error of evolution, anglers have selected a variety of exotic lures from nature's tackle box, end of quote. I enjoy all kinds of comic strips. And I get a tremendous kick sometimes out of the Sunday morning comedy hour I better not say that. But anyhow, I look at some advertisements and they're hilarious as funny. And this one is tremendously funny. I think the idea that a fish is swimming around and selecting, you know, from nature's tackle box is hilarious. I think you have to go back in time and think of the very first would-be angler and how he possibly could have developed. He waits around for this ridiculous fishing pole to grow out of the top of his head. In the meantime, he can attract no fish near. But maybe fish did just happen to come near. And so he was surviving like any other fish did. Like any other self-respecting fish, swimming around and gobbling littler fish, or hiding behind a rock and kind of leaping out at them as they come by. But he couldn't do this because, you see, he had to develop because of his ungainly structure, his slower swimming motion. And he had to develop this camouflage to look like a rock, according to evolution, or as ferns or a bed of moss, and also wait for aeons of time for this bizarre fishing pole with a worm on the end of it to grow out of the middle of his head. Now, how could that have happened? This is a terrible problem for evolution. You've got to leap over dozens of major difficulties to create a would-be angler. So we see Freddy, the frustrated fisherman, the would-be angler, busily trying to select his lure out of nature's tackle box. His eyes are different from any other fish. You've got to raise his color extending in all directions. They resemble a small urchin, or perhaps a tiny sea anemone. They're well camouflaged and unfamiliar with the bottom of the sea. He used to be a fast, leap-darting type, you know, but suddenly he got these ungainly-looking legs. He's not able now to eat the smaller fish the way he used to be, so he has to kind of lunge around with a hitch and a jerk very slowly. So he flounders and flails around on the bottom trying to get a square meal, and he can't do it. Because, you see, the anglerfish's entire bodily structure is different from that of any other fish. He's shorter, lumpy, squat, and fat. He has a great big, huge, bony head. His pectoral fins have jointed bones that are far more efficient for kind of crawling around than even swimming. His whole system, from his digestive processes to his reflexes to his bony structure to his coloration, are completely different than other fish, and they are perfectly designed to do what the anglerfish does. How did all of this just happen? A four-eyed look at evolution, I said. There's a fish that is called Anna Bletch, and that's not an old girlfriend of mine. It's a fish. It's one of the most amazing creatures on Earth, little four-eyes, or Anna Bletch tetrophthalmus, as scientists call him. They've always got to speak in Greek when they want to identify a fish. It merely means looking up four eyes. Here's one of them swimming around, looking above and below at the same time. Every now and then they take a dip to kind of water that retina, I guess. They have two separate corneas, two separate retinas at the back of the eyes. Any object seen out of the water is viewed through that special air eye on top, and anything below is viewed through that fish-like eye that is flattened that is below, and it's transmitted to the lower retina. The objects he sees under the water are transmitted to the upper retina, and what he sees above the water is transmitted down to the lower retina and seen through the upper cornea. Now, the eyes of anabrets are comparable to modern bifocal spectacles, divided into upper and lower portions. Each is adapted for a different sort of vision. How did this little creature, who spends most of his life swimming on the top of the water with a couple of eyes out and a couple of eyes in, and you can go buy these, you'd have to go to a pretty big city and a pretty good tropical fish store to find any, but I've seen them in the Los Angeles area. We had these fish. We took pictures of them in our own lab right here in Ambassador College Photographic Research Laboratory of these distinctly different eyes. But look, here's the point. Other self-respecting fish feed around the rocks on the bottoms and at various thermoclines in between. They feed on the surface. They leap free of it. They do quite well with just two eyes. But this little critter swims at the top. Now, he had to somehow survive this death-defying journey because he's got cranes and kingfishers and shrikes and shikepokes, you say, in Arkansas. Now, that's what all these birds are, in case you didn't know. And also snakes and humans and ospreys and whatnot that might eat him if he's swimming along and he can't see them coming. Now, why doesn't he just dive for the bottom and hide in the mud like any other frightened trout or any other fish would? And, well, for that matter, why not evolve into a bird and fly away from the whole problem? But somehow, somewhere, there had to be the first anabret. And he had to develop those four eyes, according to evolution. How did he do that? If the three anabrets that didn't exist were forced by natural selection to develop their extra set of eyes, which would have taken admittedly billions of years, aeons, to develop something so intricately complex as an eye, in order to survive, then the stimulus was there that caused this dramatic change to begin to develop and threaten their survival. They couldn't have survived without them, but they didn't have them. So they didn't survive, and they don't exist. No, that doesn't make sense, because they do exist with all four sets of eyes, doing perfectly what they continually do all the time. Now, let's assume, being facetious, I realize, that somewhere, somehow, one little would-be anabret, who really hadn't developed into an anabret yet, but was in the process of developing into an anabret, acquired an extra set of eyes. Swimming along one day, and all of a sudden he couldn't see anything because he was going crazy, looking in four directions at once. Dizzily, he swam about in two directions at the same time. He saw a big fish approaching from below and a kingfisher diving on him from the top. His upper cornea transmitted to the lower retina, which signaled the brain that there's danger coming. At the same time, in the opposite direction, danger from above and below. He tried to wildly leap out of the water to escape the danger from beneath, dive to the bottom to escape the danger from above, swim sideways to evade them both, and what he did is to kind of twitch a little and just lie there and stare with a baleful glance, and he got eaten in a crash collision which killed everybody, maybe. But what happened? Did others keep acquiring these sets of eyes, and you saw them twitching around with giant migraine headaches, dizzily swimming ashore and lying there twitching and saying, oh, you know, because they couldn't really control everything? I'm trying to make a point here that something as complex as four sets of eyes, not four sets, but four eyes, two sets, perfectly working with all the cones and the rods, the corneas, the retinas, and everything necessary for such a complex thing as these eyes transmitting danger signals to a brain for a little creature to survive, had to function perfectly the first time they ever existed. You don't see any such things in imperfect eye. An eye either sees or it's utterly useless. Blind people can tell you a story about that. Either you see and you see perfectly, and I'm not talking about people who begin to get problems and sicknesses and various injuries to the eye, or through aged, advanced years, begin to get dimmer vision. You know what I mean by that? I mean a good functioning eye, the way we're all born with them naturally without any deformities. They're either perfect or else they're just useless. There isn't any real in between, not even in nature. Well, you know, there are a lot of things like this that are just giant troubles for evolution. There are so many hundreds of them that you can't even begin to cover them all. But I'm going to give you at least one more to think about before the conclusion of this one program on the fifth major proof that there is a God.
For 40 years, the Plain Truth magazine has been supplying the missing dimension in education. The Plain Truth is published monthly as a facet of Ambassador College's in-the-home educational service. It maintains an editorial policy that incorporates this missing dimension in education, biblical understanding. The Plain Truth, timely, informative articles, deal with subjects covering success in business, recreation, politics, religion, farming. Each issue not only documents the state of today's society, but offers hope for a better world tomorrow. To serve its more than 6 million readers, The Plain Truth is published in 5 languages and is available without price or obligation to all who request it. Join the growing worldwide readership. Request your subscription to the magazine with a 40-year history of educational service to mankind. The Plain Truth. Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, UPO Sydney, New South Wales, 2001.
What's really simple about lungs, about breathing? There's nothing simple about that. The kind of air sacs inside our bodies are that of some fish that are called lung fish that take in air and take that oxygen and carry it via blood corpuscles to all of your cells, and your body is oxygenated, and it's the only way you can survive. In a matter of moments, minutes at the most, if you don't have that oxygen continually being carried by every beat of your heart to all parts of your body, you begin to die. Well, you know, there are fish that have lungs, and this is another one of the headaches for evolutionists. The lungfish of South America and Africa, which you will read of in this brochure, and you'll have time to study this and think about it, look it up in encyclopedias, let your kids get a look at it. It's interesting. It shows you a little bit of the humor of our Creator God, of the complex designs that He has put about us for no other purpose than man's enjoyment and man's knowledge, because the Bible commands us to look into that which is made to understand a little bit about the one who made it. In South America and Africa, you will read about the lungfish that average in size clear up to 6 feet in length and can weigh up to 100 pounds. An average size, though, of about 2.5 feet. Here's a picture of a fish with lungs, one of them up at the top and gulping air a little bit. And they're kind of a weird-looking critter. But, you know, instead of hibernation, they go into what is called estivation. There are pictures here of mud balls, of natives that dig them up and then get inside, and lo and behold, there's a lungfish in there. It's breathing, gradually dehydrating, and it goes from one pond to another over an interminable distance sometimes, and breathing the whole time, walking on its gills, and then when these shallow ponds dry up, it balls itself into a cocoon of mud and just stays there until the rains fill that pond again, and then it starts swimming and slithering around in the pond. It's a remarkable story. You'll get it right here in this brochure. Now, the next little creature is also a fantastic headache for evolutionists. It's the clownfish, and he's the fellow that exists on the cover of this brochure. They swim in and out of what really is a deadly trap to other fish, these sea anemones. Now, anemone is kind of difficult for me to pronounce sometimes, but there are some of the little creatures swimming around inside what really is a deadly mass of tentacles that have a kind of a sticky substance on them and tiny little barbs that can grasp any other fish that swims along and comes within reach of these tentacles. But these fish bury themselves in these tentacles. They play in it. They sleep, as it is, right in that protection. This is both their protection, their playground, and there's a mutual kind of a little colony going on here where they are interdependent. The fish will venture out in short little forays and snap up bits of other food, smaller fish and so on. Then they actually spit out particles. And those particles are fed upon by the sea anemones. And so the anemone benefits by eating bits of food that the little fish drops, and the little fish benefits by having a protection, a place where he can snuggle down and be safe from attack from everyone else. I remember one time I was skin diving, down off Eilat in the Red Sea in southern Israel, right across from Aqaba. And there was a ledge there, and it's a beautiful coral reef, and it goes down pretty deep outside of it, but it's very shallow. And I went down, 4 or 5 feet or something like that, and here were some great, big, beautiful anemones, and some of these clownfish. Beautiful things. The closer I got to them with my face mask on, the more they'd snuggle right inside those great, big anemones. And I wasn't about to put my hand in there. If I would back off a ways, then they would come out and begin kind of swimming around in circles. It was a fabulous sight. Well, this brochure shows you that there are questions which are absolutely unanswerable by evolutionists, and it shows you some very embarrassing quotations, some of the strangest admissions from a scientific source that you will ever read, of how they simply set questions aside that they cannot answer. I say again, as I've said so many times, evolution is a religion. It is as much a faith as any other religion in the world. It has its own accoutrements and paraphernalia, just as much as Oriental religions have ancestor worship, shrines, upturned corners of eaves of buildings, just as much as they have leering idols with large navels, maybe a naval jewel once in a while, and 8 or 10 or 16 arms, just as much as the so-called Christian religion has different kinds of garb and different kinds of ceremonies, different identifiable churches with different identifiable symbols upon them. And sometimes, as I said at the beginning of this program about some of these monuments and symbols, you begin to wonder about that. You begin to wonder, what is a steeple? Where did it come from? How did it get started? Did they climb up on Priscilla and Aquila's tent that you read of in the book of Acts, where the Apostle Paul met with a group of people in that very first century and put a steeple on top of it? And what does a steeple really stand for? Why do people make steeples out of their hands and think that's a religious gesture? Wouldn't it be just as religious to stand on your head? But at any rate, evolution ought to be linked together with or labeled as a religion or as a superstition. It has its own idolatry. Its idolatry are various fossils and the vast missing links that don't exist, which is faith, in other words, that people look at something they don't see and they believe in it. Now, the evolutionists aren't making altars to them. But if you want to find out about your origins, they tell you to go to the latest edition in the museum. You go to the big museum and you walk along, you see an amoeba, and you see various salamanders and amphibians. You see the age of fish, like the Devonian age they talk about, the Silurian, maybe the Permian age. You talk about all the ages that the strata are supposed to reveal, which is silly once you really look into it. I'd like to tell you about this brochure you ought to write in for, which is absolutely free of charge, which will give you some very, very interesting insight into some of the questions I have brought up right here on this program. You'll see some of the most beautiful color photography you can imagine. You'll see and understand about anopheles, the little four-eyed fish, about lungfish, and how could these creatures have possibly evolved. It's free of charge, a fishy story, the story of evolution. All you need to do is to address your letter to Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Remember, there is no charge for the plain truth, for any book that you write for any literature I announce, no request for money. It is absolutely free to you if you write to Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.